In the Thick of It, a Profit and Loss podcast with Colin Lambert and Galen Stobbs.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to In the Thick of It, Profit and Loss's weekly podcast. I'm Colin Lambert, Managing Editor of Profit and Loss. And with me, as always, is Galen Stobbs, Editor of P&L. And before we start, Galen, I think I need to apologise to our listeners for the fact that our podcast last week was hacked and some moron appeared on predicting that Germany would win the World Cup.
Yeah, so for those who didn't hear it, Colin picked Germany to win the World Cup and England, who of course also lost this week, as his dark horses for the tournament. Unlucky there. Who are you picking now to replace Germany as your World Cup favourites then, Colin?
Well, obviously, as I want England to actually go well, I feel it's my duty to pick Colombia. So Colombia for the World Cup. You heard it here first, everybody.
And then the famous Colin Lambert kiss of death.
Exactly. It's worked before and it'll work again. But yes. So yeah, not the best not the best week for my predictive powers, but there you go. I've had worse.
So Colin, at the moment you're actually in South Africa, right?
Yes, I'm stalking the Global Foreign Exchange Committee. I'm not for any lawyers listening.
but what are you actually doing there?
I'm here, just been running an ACI Australia dealing simulation course for the IMF. We just had 30 African central bankers for a week, which was a lot of hard work and a lot of good fun. But along the way, I did actually get time, you know, fortuitously, the GFXC meeting was on just across the city. So I managed to get over and have a sit down with Simon Potter, Adrian Bowler, and Akira Hoshino, Simon's the chair and the two co-vice chairs. So it was quite handy to get sort of 45 minutes in the room with them after their meeting.
What was your takeaway from that?
Well, the mood was definitely positive, I have to say. There was a lot of optimism, and I get that because I think, you know, sometimes we can be guilty of expecting too much of things. And the fact they've got, you know, sort of 300 plus signatures, if you take out the multiple signatories, you know, some firms are on every register, for instance, it may be just slightly short of that. But in terms of like sell side, they've done really well. And I think, you know, there's a mood of optimism about the GFXC about that. And that's fine. I think my one nagging concern remains that I think everyone accepts that the buy side hasn't embraced this as quite as much. And also that the non-bank market makers outside of the four that have signed a statement of commitment also haven't done so. So, and I tried to raise it, and I think, you know, I got the answer that, you know, it's part of an education effort, it's part of an outreach effort, and it's ongoing, and I get things do take time. I kind of wish that the GFXC, and I've spoken to four or five people on the GFXC and that agree with me, and others that don't, I have to point out. But I think there's a sense now that they would be better served having a sense of realism about the fact that, yes, you know what, we do actually need to make a greater effort to engage with the buy side, and we do need to make sure that those high frequency non-bank market makers below the top tier, and including some top tiers, we have to point out, actually do also, you know, engage with the code. Because so, yeah, I mean, I'm still a little bit mixed emotions about it. I think the cover and deal work is coming along well, is what they told me, and they seem very happy with that. And I get that it's a very complex issue, and they've got to make sure they get the proper understanding out there. Ultimately, it's all about disclosures, and it worries me a little bit that when we keep on talking about disclosures, I always come back to the sort of legal disclosures at the bottom of every investment flyer about past performance, and those disclosures have gone to like 37 pages now. So when we're talking about disclosures, I do get a little bit nervous, because to me that's bringing the legal side of the world into the equation. Now, I have to say, Simon Potter was very, very firm that this is not about the legals. This is only my sense, but he was firm that what they're doing is sticking principles in place around the disclosures, but the actual disclosures themselves are a matter for, you know, the bank's oversight, compliance, and governance teams. I just worry that if you know, if we get into too deep into the weeds over disclosures, we could end up with a bunch of lawyers sitting around the table, which rarely is healthy in my estimation. So, yeah, I'm a little bit mixed emotions about it, to be honest. But, yeah, it's you know, it is what it is. It's a work in progress.
So you obviously reported on that kind of progress and the new leadership team. Another thing in the news this week that we reported on was BNY Mellon launching FX options. And we kind of we talked about this when we put two pieces out, one kind of just talking about the options and one kind of trying to piece it in the broader context of what they're trying to build at BNY Mellon at the moment. And to my mind, it's interesting because obviously they've had a lot of new staff there, i.e. they hired half of Deutsche Bank's FX team, as far as I can tell. They
other banks do exist.
Yeah, I know. but to my mind, it's interesting, not just in BNY specific, but kind of thinking more broadly about the space that custodian banks have typically occupied in the FX market, which is they've always had a great kind of customer franchise, right? They work with all these these really good quality firms doing kind of the custody piece, the collateral piece. But, you know, people would park their assets and do one part of their business with these custodian banks. But when it came time to execute, you know, they'd go somewhere else. And you could imagine, you know, there is a certain logic, right, to having everything in one place, which it seems like that's what Boney's trying to build with the PB, with the FX options, building out kind of a more modern kind of e-trading desk. Do you think it's going to be challenging, not just for them, but for custodian banks more broadly, to kind of evolve from what they've traditionally been into having a kind of a proper FX execution trading style desk?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I mean, I have to say, I was quite surprised they didn't have an options desk already. So I thought most banks had FX options desk. That came as a bit of a revelation to me. In answer to your question, I think it comes down that the how successful they'll be, I honestly believe will come down to the risk profile they're willing to adopt. Because I think in terms of sort of building an EFX business, in terms of building an execution and the PB business, what we're really talking about is technology. And the cost of technology and the deployment of technology has really become much lower in recent years. And there's some really good products out there. And there's some really good they've got some really good people around there as well who have been a part of building other platforms. So I think in terms of actually then building out the technology aspects of it, I think custodial banks, as long as they're willing to sort of spend some reasonable cash on the technology. I mean, they don't have to go crazy, but spend some reasonable cash to get some to get a good product suite there. Then I think that's the easy part of it. To me, the challenge will be: are they willing to accept the risk that comes with having to quote their traditional customer base options? You know, these guys have been going to the Deutsches, the B of A's, the Credit Suisse's, the UBS's of this world for FX option pricing for quite a long while. Are the custodial banks going to be willing to actually sort of put that sort of risk profile on the line where somebody wants a sort of, you know, 25 delta, 3 months dollar Swiss in a yard of dollars? Are they actually going to be willing to quote that, or are they just going to become like, to go back to my original point about the GFXE, a cover and deal shop, where they just literally just back to back the risk? So to me, I think, I don't think the technology should be a challenge for them. And they've got some good people in all of the custodial banks. You look at, you know, some of the efforts that have been made at Northern Trust. Yeah, I know they're at the smaller end of that sort of scale, but Northern Trust have done a really good job of building out a platform relevant for their client base. I wonder, and I think you're a bit closer to it than me, but I wonder, are the moves by Boney actually aimed at pushing them outside of that custody space as well, you know, into sort of, you know, a broader client base?
I think that's an interesting point. You're definitely right on the technology piece. I mean, smaller banks I speak to now kind of praise the technology that's available to them at like a, you know, a really high quality at a good price point for them. Just if anything else, just one of the things that you're always going to come up against, right, is changing client behavior is very difficult. Yep. They won't change it if it's just a little bit more efficient or a little bit more easy operationally or process-wise, right? The pain point or the value add has to be quite substantial before they'll actually change their behavior. So I think that's one challenge. It's not just offering kind of a better proposition for them, but it has to be so much better that they can't ignore it.
Well, I think that's where I think the risk profile is going to be important, because I honestly am not convinced that anybody can make the technology alone that much more of a powerful proposition than that exists. I don't think they can come out with something out of the box, you know, that they've created that is significantly better than everything else out there. However, there are a lot of very big relationships between the custodial banks and their clients. And that, I think, they really can leverage and can make a difference. You know, they've dealt with each other for many years. There is a trust factor there as such. It's been damaged a little bit by events of the last few years. But there's a trust factor. There's a deep relationship there. And therefore, I think if they can leverage that with good technology and risk profile, then all of a sudden they've got half a chance. Otherwise, I think they'll just be adding to the ranks of middle tier banks that are okay at EFX.
Yeah.
I mean, it'd be an interesting one, because I think the quality of people they've hired there, to me, warrants, you know, they've earned the respect of the industry, and they've earned the right to actually sort of, you know, make us sit up and pay attention. So we may be pleasantly surprised. And I think, you know, generally speaking, Michelle Neal is a driver. She knows what she wants from her business, and she'll back her teams to actually deliver it. So I wouldn't be surprised if they have a much stronger relationship with their core client franchises in 3 years' time, but maybe a not further down the road with the other client groups, such as hedge funds, which frankly are struggling along anyway. So yeah, I think that's one to watch. I think
that's a pretty fair assessment.
I think the other news this week was, it's a couple of things, and it's something I wanted to pick your brains on, because we spoke in last week's podcast about OTCXN, and they bought Og Trading, and then on, I think it was Monday or Tuesday, they announced that they had conducted a test trade between a fiat and a cryptocurrency. I think it was tokenized dollars and Bitcoin. And then I think around the same time, COBOL unveiled its new credit platform, which of course is also based upon sort of, you know, I think they kind of call it, was it super blockchain or enhanced blockchain? So the simple question is, I mean, something that's always stuck in my mind is something you raised for the first time in my sort of knowledge, was around, you know, is blockchain a solution looking for a problem? Are we now, with these products, now starting to see hard evidence of usage of blockchain?
Yes and no. So I think certainly there was kind of this hype cycle that peaked, I'd say, around 2016 in terms of blockchain, right? We were going to use blockchain for everything. Blockchain was the solution to problems you didn't even know existed, et cetera, et cetera. And I think following that, there's been a bit of fatigue where kind of a lot of firms were kind of went, okay, look, when you have a blockchain solution that's ready and actually works, and could be used in anger straight away, come back and show me. The other problem for a lot of the blockchain solutions is the problem that I mentioned just a minute ago, which is a lot of the big financial institutions, if I show them a solution promising 20, 25% greater efficiencies, and a lot of the blockchain stuff is an efficiency play, right? Big financial institution, from what I've heard speaking to them, unless it's kind of, you know, 40% and above efficiency gains, they won't even look at the solution, because it's not deemed kind of worth the effort of changing the operations and technology and structure. So
is that a cost thing?
One challenge.
Is that a cost thing on the part of these institutions?
I don't know exactly how the calculation gets made, but I think it's deemed that not just the cost, but the time, the resources, the manpower, and everything associated with kind of changing something that big is deemed kind of not worth it unless it's kind of higher than a certain percentage. I don't know. I assume there's someone who sat around and done the calculation and decided at this point we start looking at it. So I think that's probably from, are we seeing solutions now? Honestly, I think COBOL are kind of ahead of the pack in that they've kind of identified one specific kind of use case and they've really kind of focused in on that. I don't see a huge amount of other blockchain things getting a lot of real traction. The test trade was interesting, but it's still, until it goes live and is being used regularly, it's still a bit more of kind of a novelty item at this point in time.
Yeah. I guess one of the things that we're talking about people rolling out products. The rolling out of a product does not necessarily mean that the world is going to use them. You know, the history is littered with products that were really good but never actually got any use.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I was actually at a crypto event earlier this week, and it was in New York, and there were a lot of familiar FX craze faces in the audience. Now, it was pretty much all platform providers, the people that I recognized. And it was funny, so I was literally, I was just messaging some thoughts back and forth with someone there, and one of their comments to me, because they were asking me my thoughts from kind of an FX perspective, and they said to me that they thought it was a little odd that everyone was knee-deep in the struggle to fit the round crypto peg into the very square institutional hole. And he was critical that none of them had the self-awareness to see that the nature of the problem lies in the paradox of trying to fit an anarchist widget into the capitalist tool belt. I don't necessarily agree with that assessment, but I think it is interesting sometimes when people are looking at kind of trying to get the crypto kind of into the institutional space, sometimes it does feel like they're trying to very much just put what we had in the institutional space and just kind of force that onto crypto, when it, in some cases it might be the whole point of crypto was kind of a rejection of the established system. And we complain about the operations, the amount of times I've heard like, oh, you know what crypto needs? It needs kind of like a PB, like a credit solution like the PB. But all people have done for the past 3 years is complain about PBs and access to credit in the FX market. So why are we trying to force a solution that's under strain there onto this new paradigm? Why can't we create something new? So those comments got me thinking. One of the, probably to my mind, the most interesting comments was made at the event by Don Wilson, the CEO of DRW. And he got asked about kind of first mover advantage versus kind of late mover advantage in this space. And he made kind of an interesting point that Ethereum, if it got launched today, he said would probably be classified as a security and kind of clamped down on pretty quickly. But because they just went ahead without being asked, it's now so decentralized that it's not deemed a security and it's going to kind of, you know, probably go on to thrive. So a lot of times it's worth just kind of plowing ahead and just, you know, asking for forgiveness if you need to further down the line than permission, which I thought was kind of an interesting perspective when there's so many people, institutional players in the wanting to get into the crypto space, but begging for more regulation so they know what to do. Mm. You know, maybe some of them should just kind of go ahead and do it.
Well, there's that to it as well. I think it, to me also, is it going to be one of those things? I mean, I thought it was lovely that you used the round and square analogy. There are people of a certain generation that remember sort of the hippies where everyone that was non-hippie was a square. And thankfully, I'm just too young for that generation. But no, I mean, I think, to me, it's quite interesting in this space because all I see is people trying to rein crypto in. To me, everything you described there about institutions and regulators and, you know, whether it's going to be classed as security, to me, that's all about the establishment trying to sort of rein in, or, you know, the parents trying to control the sort of out of control sort of 7-year-old, as it probably is about now. And that really takes us away from what the original ethos of crypto was. Ultimately, it seems to me they're just trying to make it another currency.
Yeah, and to be fair, one of the SEC regulators they had there, when he was talking about the regulatory kind of uncertainty, he said a lot of the uncertainty is just self-inflicted. Like, it's the industry, financial industry, like getting itself worked up, not the regulators. I mean, his kind of essential point was, look, these, what's unique about digital assets is that isn't that they're digital. I mean, most assets that we trade now are, you know, on a screen. It's more that they exist on this distributed ledger. Now, and he kind of made the point that, look, just because an asset exists and moves on a digital ledger that solves a trust problem, it doesn't mean for any reason that asset should be outside the normal trading protocol. So basically, you know, treat it just like another kind of new, but another asset.
I think it's one of those things that's going to run and run, because I think there's, on one hand, there's a fear of crypto on the part of the more reactionary elements in the world. And on the other hand, there's this sort of mad dash to avoid being reined in by the man. The solution probably lies somewhere in the middle. And, you know, maybe for once there, what you've heard is a regulator actually talks some common sense. And it's not, frankly, something we're used to at the moment. But, sadly, this week, we don't have an academic paper from a regulator to really sort of dig into. So, unfortunately, we're breaking that tradition after 3 weeks. But I think you wanted to sort of raise some fact-checking issues from an event you were at this week.
Yeah, so the Next Group hosted an event, a very interesting event this week, actually. And there were two interesting things there. So last week we talked about a report released by Michael Greenberger, who used to work at the CFTC, saying that the banks had found a little loophole around the swaps regulation, and that kind of this could pose a risk to sort of the U.S. system, and ultimately U.S. taxpayers are still on the hook for supposedly de-guaranteed foreign entities. And I got the chance to bring up those comments with Timothy Massad, who was chairman of the CFTC for at least part of the time that the report was addressing. So I asked him for his thoughts on the paper, and I didn't really get much of an answer. I mean, to be fair to him, he hadn't read the paper, so it was difficult for him to comment on it. But he kind of said something about, oh yes, but we had margin rules, and we had other rules that kind of actually negated that and made sure that it was safe after all. So that
call
that
me
was
a cynic, but I reckon he had read it.
Far too cynical. I tell you what, Massad is much friendlier and chattier now that he's not at the CFTC.
There's probably a scientific link between those two things.
Well, yeah. It used to be that as a journalist, you know, he wouldn't use three words when one would do, and wasn't kind of that open, whereas he was very chatty and willing to talk in general at the event. What I wanted to bring up was straight away after the event, I had some people come up to me and asked if I could do some fact-checking. So they had some very very senior, very talented people up on the panel. There was one in particular who reeled off a lot of very interesting sounding stats. I'm just not sure how many people in the audience believed them. So out of the stats,
well,
that,
I will be your fact checker.
You'll be my fact checker. Okay. So here's one of the facts that they raised, which was they said that JP Morgan currently has 43,000 compliance staff and spends $70 billion a year on compliance.
JP Morgan employs about a quarter. JP Morgan.
I'm looking, they've got 252,000. Yeah, 252,000 last year. So that would mean that just almost a fifth of their staff is now compliance.
And $70 billion. You know what? I hope that's wrong. I genuinely hope that's wrong. And I want to say fake, but there's this little nagging fear inside of me, because I remember it wasn't that many years ago, but quite a few years ago, Barclays were going to move into their new trading floor in London, in their new building with their name on it. And I think about 7-8 years on, they're still in the old trading room, because the whole of the building, the new building at Canary Wharf, was actually taken by compliance. I reckon that's probably a little bit loose with the facts. I would suspect that's including a lot of people that are on the periphery of compliance.
Okay,
what's
next
your other one?
Okay, I got two more. So next one is that 70% of financial institutions have a blockchain strategy, but 70% of financial institutions do not have an AI strategy. Now, I think that sounds like it could be right, but I just thought 70 and 70 was a bit suspiciously neat.
Yeah, I would say that.
And I don't know where those stats are coming from.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at it, I guess, in terms of institutions, there's a vast part of the world that actually has never even heard of, you know, sort of Facebook nearly. So I would imagine, in terms of institutions, are they talking US institutions or global institutions?
Because I would say. Didn't specify.
Yeah, I mean, globally, it could be right, because you've got whole continents where they're not even thinking about AI. Although then again, you've got China, which is very much thinking about AI, and that would boost the numbers. Now, I'm not happy with that one, I have to say, because I don't think many financial institutions have actually got a blockchain strategy. I think they're waiting for someone else, as we were referring to earlier. They're waiting for someone else to come up with a really compelling solution for them. So I think their strategy, if you consider wait and see if someone can sell me something to be a strategy, then yes, they do. But I'm not buying that one, I'm afraid, mate. I'm not buying that one.
And the last one is the one that I think most people had an issue with, which was they claim that only 4% of Americans have passports.
Well, you know what? There was a time back in the day when that was alleged. I think that was fairly close to being true. If nothing else, I would say it's false, because every member of the U.S. Armed Forces has to have a passport to serve abroad. And there's a lot of them serving abroad at the moment. I suspect that's a 4%. That would be amazing. I'm calling that fake. You know, if I was the Donald, I'd have capital letters for fake news on that one.
So what I'm going to do is I'm going to try and fact check these, and I'm going to report back on next week on how
Excellent.
Close or far away we were, and see if I can track down where that 70 and 70 numbers came from.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, as we're on to slightly bizarre things, actually, now, one thing I wanted to raise was just yesterday, I guess we need to do a little bit of backstory. So 2 years ago, the five major Australian banks were found guilty by ASIC, the local regulator, of attempts at manipulating the foreign exchange market, front-running client orders, and inappropriately sharing confidential information. Now, to veterans of the FX industry, this is sadly familiar now, because this is exactly what we've been talking about for 5 years. And we were trying to work out, I mean, what do you reckon the banks in the, you know, have been fined by the US and UK in terms of dollars? What do you reckon?
I haven't checked where it's up to now, but it's in the billions.
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine it's in the tens of billions for foreign exchange alone.
Yeah.
Well, so the five Australian banks were basically, NAB, I'm actually going to pick on here. NAB were fined $2.5 million Australian dollars.
That's with an M.
So, yes, that is with an M, not a B. I think the others were $2.5 to $4 million. And they were given an enforcement undertaking, which meant they had to sort of reform their business according to a program and have it verified by an independent expert. So yesterday, ASIC reported that NAB has failed to deliver the reform program and has still got significant gaps.
So then they brought down the hammer?
Yep, what they did, they said, okay, we're going to give you a few other guidelines you've got to meet, but we're not going to change the fine. So on one hand, you've got sort of, I guess, the US system where banks are fined billions of dollars by three or four different regulators. They have to put a program in place, and they do so very quickly. Otherwise, they're probably going to be thrown out of the country. And on the other hand, we've got, you know, a country going, well, you know, you're pretty bad boys. We're going to fine you a couple of million dollars. Oh, you haven't put things right yet. Oh, well, don't worry about it. Have a little bit longer. I mean, this could be a play for you know, the world to come to Sydney. Because
regulatory arbitrage right there.
I think it is. I mean, you know, I don't know how much it would cost to relocate JP Morgan and Citi from New York to Sydney. But you know what? It probably wouldn't be as much as those fines they paid. If they're going to get done $2.5 million every time they get it. So, yeah, I found that one a little bit bizarre this week. Perhaps we should, you know, just sort of fact check some of the things around ASIC and the Australian banks. But that's probably getting into too sensitive a territory.
Probably.
So, yes. Yeah. So we've nearly done our time. And I think what we wanted to do was close out on sadly a somber note, because I got news on Monday morning. Sadly, on Monday morning, I had to publish the news that Paul Chappell, the sort of CIO and founder of Currency Manager Seaview and Director of Education at ACI, had sadly passed away on Sunday. I mean, it's tremendously sad news. I mean, Paul was a friend of mine. I've known him for 30, 40 years. And, you know, I saw him, I had lunch with him literally 4 or 5 weeks ago. So it's tremendously sad news. And something that really struck me about it was the amount of messages that I received from people, you know, all saying the same thing. It's, you know, there's hard, sometimes it's hard to explain that, you know, how these things happen. But I think, you know, it's tremendously sad. But I think what I'd like to, I mean, obviously we published a story and we obviously extend our deepest condolences to Paul's, you know, family, friends and colleagues. And he will be sadly missed because he was a real advocate and a really passionate advocate for, you know, conduct and reform in the foreign exchange market. But I thought probably a good way for us to finish on this would be an upbeat note, because I know you want, I think, you know, your interaction with him was pretty good a couple of years ago on the panel, which we can close out with. But to my mind, I thought the great thing about Paul was he would make you feel really sort of, I guess, it's hard to put it into words. He was such an engaging person when he wanted to be. And it was, you sort of look at it. And I remember Paul invited me once to a golf day. And I'm thinking, wow, that's really fantastic. He knows I'm rubbish at golf. And we sort of turned up and I sunk the course out. And at the end of the round, he walked over and said, he looked at my scorecard and he went, I thought that would be the case. To pay me back, you can run the auction for me tonight. It was like, and I think, I go like, Paul, okay, that's fine. That's, you know, I think that was planned after a thing. And I guess the other thing is that the thing that you put together in London a couple of years ago at a London conference, which I was part of, and I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, so obviously it's terribly sad news, and it's such a big professional and personal loss. I mean, he was a great guy and a great advocate for the FX industry. I remember when I first started writing about FX, you know, the first person that everyone told me to go and see was like, oh, you've got to go and sit down with Paul Chappell and kind of have him talk you through the industry. And I did, and they were absolutely right to send me in his direction. He was a wealth of knowledge and so happy to kind of sit down and talk about the industry that he cared about so much, which was great to see that kind of that passion in him for the industry, even after so long in it. My abiding memory of him will always be in London a couple of years ago, we did an old Codgers quiz in which you and Paul was one of the participants in. And for one of the segments, I went through the old P&L back archives and I found a wonderful magazine. It was the first year P&L was launched, 1999. And there was a piece which was a day in the life of a dealer that was penned by none other than Paul Chappell himself. And firstly, it was a wonderful piece, namely because he literally grumbled about all the same thing that people grumble about now, right? How about, like, oh, yes, liquidity isn't like it was back in the day and all of this stuff that we still complain about now. So I thought that was great. So we did, as one of the segments, like, interspersed throughout the whole quiz, we did, you know, guess the quote, right? So I'd read out a particularly funny segment, and they all came from the piece he wrote, His Day in the Life of a Dealer. And that was the obvious gag, right, which was it all came from the same person in the same article. And yet every time I read out a particularly moany piece about something or a particularly funny piece about how, you know, the Americans didn't know how to trade, they'd all gone off for martinis already and stuff like that. Every time he guessed someone else, like he just like, oh, that couldn't be me. It doesn't sound like me. And every time it obviously was. Even on the fifth quote, he still didn't get it. It was hilarious. That was great fun, and I'll always definitely remember that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, as I say, I mean, it's terribly sad news. But I think hopefully Paul would appreciate the fact that we are remembering him with a couple of happy memories of, you know, some of the fun times we've had with him as well, because he's done a lot of good in industry and, say, with his charity work as well outside of that. So, with a heartfelt rest in peace to Paul Chappell, we are going to close out now. We'll be back next week with the In the Thick of It, and we'll speak to you again then. Thanks very much for listening.